I'm Lachlan Rouston.
And this is Raph Friedman, and we are best known as hosts of the Mind Muscle Project podcast.
And you're listening to the top resource for personal trainers, fitness coaches, and gym owners, the In the Black Business Podcast.
Mind Muscle Project, welcome back. Today we have back on Hewitt. It's our second round. He is partner of the show as well. So he is the co-founder and CEO of Team Builder. So if you don't know Team Builder, you actually might but not have realized it. So we use it for all our programs. So like Project Strong, Project Fitness, Project Body. We deliver it through Team Builder. It's cool because it's got the My Muscle Project logo on it, but we are using Team Builder's platform and they're genius and all the stuff. You know, we don't develop that app ourselves. That's all Hewitt, which is really, really cool. Connor, our producer, first introduced us years ago because he's been using the platform for years. We're just talking before the show. It's now reached over 3,000 companies actually use Team Builder, which doesn't mean 3,000 people use it. It means hundreds of thousands of people have probably used this app and get training programs from it, which is very, very cool. And you just launched payments through the platform as well, which we'll talk about. But yeah, Hewitt, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me again. Love being on.
Man, so I'm very excited. So what I wanted to start with today is that you know, very common, particularly in fitness right now, is that people think, hey, I should maybe start some sort of app myself, particularly as, you know, people have really good followings or just, you know, it's a very repetitive industry because you're having to explain nutrition and training programs over and over again, you know, to just a lot of people, no matter how you do fitness, even high ticket or low ticket, it's still a lot of volume. So apps just like make a lot of sense. And a lot of people look at it, say, wow, you know, I could probably improve the apps out there. My MyFitnessPal doesn't do this. I got a great idea. You know, I could do this with it. But what is confusing is the different amounts of money and effort that seems to go into apps. So some people seem to be able to, you know, just pay somebody and they get them an app up and running within a month. Then there seems to be other people that have set aside 18 months and have raised $4 million and they still can't get their app live on the app store. And they never seem to be too worried about it. And then there's maybe people like you, which is more of a middle ground, I think, that you clearly got people that like know how to write code and know how to build apps behind the scenes, but you're also not really trying to take on Instagram probably and, you know, doing huge fundraising and crazy valuations early on. So tell me if there's another type of app that's in there, or maybe just tell me, yeah, how you see Team Builder fit into that.
Yeah, I guess I'll start when I first started Team Builder, like years and years ago, it was actually more common for me to talk to organizations that were, that stated that they were floating the idea of creating their own app in-house, right? I used to hear that all the time. And that was because like we were like the newcomer, there weren't a lot of apps out there to choose from. So people were like, oh, I'm just thinking about creating my own app. It never worked. I never saw an organization actually successful.
Do you mean an organization that's not a tech one? So maybe it would be like a gym or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, like we talked to a lot of professional organizations, professional NBA and MLB teams and NFL teams that thought they had the resources to do this. And basically what people find out and what we know all too well is that an app, building an application is a multifaceted process. So when you mention apps that people seem to launch really quickly and put out there in like a month, oftentimes apps that don't store information, that are just simply showing information, those apps are pretty easy to build. If your goal is just to get a workout out to someone and display the workout to them as like an instruction, that's actually not very hard to do. Where the game changes is where you make the decision of, am I going to store people's data for them?
Right. And so that would be saving a workout score or uploading your video of your deadlift.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And at Team Builder, we store everything, every little bit, tiny piece of data that every user contributes, we store in a database. So basically you can divide an application into front end and back end. And front end, fine. You can use a lot of templates out there to build a front end app. When you get into the back end, now you're talking investment. So you have front end, back end for a web, and that's where you get on your browser, you access an app. Then you have one for Apple's iOS app store, and then you have one for Android. And those essentially will be three different products. So if you have something on all three, you don't just have one app, you have three apps. And you, every time you update one, you have to go to the others and do the same thing. But the process is different for those three. So when you start getting into those details, people start getting bored around this point because that's where it starts getting really kind of, you know, now you're an app company. You're not just a PT or a coach building your app on the side. this becomes like a fully devoted sort of project.
And what sort of skill level are we talking about? Is this like something that YouTube tutorials will get you there, or it's how you kind of really need help from overseas or like someone that's technical?
You need help. Yeah. So there's another important term that people should know if they get into to apps. It's called technical debt. You can build your way to a functionality, but it doesn't mean that you can build on top of that functionality. Mm. So what I mean is like if you build a, if you have a, like a weight room's 1,000 square feet and then you lay it out a certain way, and then you want to start incorporating something totally different, like a different modality into your programming, but your weight room doesn't suit that, you have to take it all down again and then rebuild it. And maybe even expand it. So that happens in app development all the time, called rabbit holes. So if you build a functionality, you might get that out. But if you have plans to build more, you have to tear it all down again, rebuild it again in a more scalable, functional way. That process can get really frustrating. People put a lot of money into apps, right? So we use an agency for our mobile app development early on in our company's history. And a professional sports player here in the States, I won't say their name, but you know, sometimes they make a lot of money and they have to put their money to work in different ways. And this one guy had an idea for an app. I think he spent $200,000 or $300,000 here in the States with this agency before he gave up, because he kept getting himself into rabbit holes by demanding that certain features be built. And he wasn't a technical person. So he put a lot of money away into something that ended up being worthless. And you see that all too often in app development, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's probably just confusing people that maybe haven't done it before, you know, the consequences of maybe those types of decisions. And isn't there also, like, do you feel like that the layperson can even engage in an agency like that? Because I've heard kind of more horror stories where it's like they go to the agency builds it quite complicated because they know they want to keep the work long term and don't want to like leave the person with the app. Is that a common scenario as well?
I think it is all too often. I'm afraid it is. I would be really wary of committing, treating an agency like a business partner is dangerous, because they are an agency at the end of the day, trading time for money.
Yeah.
When you have a partner, that things change a little bit. So, you know, when people fundraise to grow a company, they typically won't go out and use that capital to hire an agency. They're going to hire employees in house because you want that partnership. You want that skin in the game, because it creates a difference in quality to your product, I believe.
Yes, and a difference in incentives, right? So is that, where would you put Team Builder in that process? Did you mentioned agency, but how have you done, like between yourself doing the work or your business partner, employees and agencies, what route did you guys go down?
Well, I was really lucky to have a business partner, James, who was technically very apt. He's probably the most talented person I know at self-teaching himself. How to do things, technically speaking. We were able to get a concept, an app concept, off the ground and actually generating a little bit of revenue before we went out and sought an agency.
Wow.
So when we took on an agency, we had enough of a technical base to where we could steer this agency the right way. They weren't necessarily building our product from the ground up. So we had an advantage in doing that. So with that being said, anyone who has ambitions of building an application or a technical product absolutely should have a business partner or a partner in the business that is a technical partner that can be sort of a foundation for that, because otherwise you're relying on people who don't have the same skin in the game, like I said.
You feel like you're just too exposed, you think, from getting just led down the wrong path or just not having too many blind spots?
I think you just have so little autonomy over your own product. Your best interest as a partner in a business is the long-term success of it. You're in it for the long haul, hypothetically speaking. An agency or someone who's working on a contract basis, if they don't take part in that successful outcome long-term, you're not going to get the same sort of thinking, the same sort of perspective as it comes to working on that product.
Okay. That makes sense. And then in terms of like the finances for it, is an app, I mean, I'm sure it's all different, but like say for a gym, people often used to is like, yeah, you can often kind of start making money within the first 4-6 months, but there's a big outlay often just open a gym as well. And it might take you like a couple years to a third year to like get all your money back that you put into the business and kind of make sure you got that return. Where would you put apps on that sort of time frame? Is it something that you know you can do really well with very quickly, or it's like, hey, you build users and it is very long term?
You know, I personally believe that technical applications as a business are like a high risk, high reward kind of game. So high risk would be raising a lot of capital, spending a lot of capital.
Yeah.
And the high reward is when, you know, our buddies at True Coach, you know, they probably experienced something that would be considered a high reward outcome.
Because they got a lot of users and they sold the company.
Yeah, they raised a decent amount of capital. Mm. They grew, they had a lot of users. I think they showed a lot of growth. And their outcome, their acquisition was outsized for our industry. You just don't see it very often when you're selling to strength and conditioning and performance coaches. Mm. And they have a lot of personal trainers as well, which is a big market. So high risk, high reward. Taking on capital, Team Builder didn't do it. And it's only because we don't necessarily feel like adhering to that timeline. James and I personally love our product. We love our customers and we like our business and we like our employees. Mm. So if we're growing steadily and we can do this 20 years from now, I think we're very happy. You might've heard this thing in Japanese business culture where it's the 100-year business. You know, when you start a business in Japan, you don't necessarily want to have a McDonald's in every city around the world. You want to have a business that's still standing in 100 years, whether that's making, you know, a couple hundred knives a year, and you do that every year for 100 years, you know, or whatever. Mm. We like that philosophy because we like our business. And as long as it's financially viable, we don't necessarily feel the urge to raise capital to make it more expansive. I think the only scenario that we would raise capital is if we felt like we were falling behind. And we don't necessarily feel that happening yet. So we don't prefer to raise capital. However, I will say that if you do raise capital, it's not a bad idea either, because mm. the folks who disperse capital to startups, they're not necessarily counting on your one company to bring them success. They invest in multiple companies, 10, 20 companies. And oftentimes they're counting on those one or two to have the outsized success to provide the return on the ones who failed. So if you raise capital and you go for it and you shoot a moonshot and fail, well, you use someone else's money. You probably learned a lot in the process, and the fund then invested in you. They probably have another company that's doing really well, and you know, you shouldn't worry about it. So it's not a zero sum game when you raise capital. I think it's totally fine to do.
Yeah, I think probably the right thing you said there, which is like somebody else's money, you got to learn all the experiences, even if you didn't make a dollar out, which is pretty good. You usually have to pay to learn stuff, right?
You usually have to pay to learn stuff. And you know, when you're a first time founder, or when you're, you know, founding a company that's not yet profitable, you probably don't pay yourself a whole lot, maybe don't pay yourself at all. But it's a pretty rich experience. It's a pretty rich experience. And, you know, once you've done it a few times, I think it gives you some clout to try it again. I don't think it's a bad business to be in. It's a little bit volatile, you know, probably stressful. You're using someone else's money. They give you a timeline, right? James and I don't have that. We don't have investors that we have to give a quarterly update to, and they're not necessarily hounding us about hitting their milestones that are completely arbitrary, right? There's some quality of life aspect to that that we enjoy that other founders who maybe raise capital, they don't enjoy.
Yeah. And they probably make, you know, decisions that might not be the best for the company, but best for the quarter to go back and tell their bosses.
That's right. If you're under pressure to generate revenue, you're going to fail fast and often. That can become a frustrating process. James and I don't mind failing, but we'd prefer not to because we are a bootstrap company. It is our money at play. So when we build features or commit to technical projects, we want to make sure that we're hitting triples and not swinging at strikes to try to hit home runs, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I was just looking up, because I remember when you mentioned the business in Japan, the oldest family business in Japan started in 718. It's a hotel, 46 generations. It's impressive, right? It's been through a lot.
That's,
I mean, for them, they must be like, man, this COVID's probably hit them pretty hard, the hotel, but they're probably thinking, look, we've seen worse.
Oh.
They've probably seen like every plague there is.
We're not going anywhere. It's amazing to me.
That is amazing. So, yeah, they would have seen some other plagues where they definitely didn't get vaccines and trackers and QR codes.
Yeah, true. They probably saw some more. They probably saw bubonic plague. It's so counter to maybe American business culture. Hmm. You know, but there's like this slang term for a small business here. You might use it the same, like mom and pop shop, mom and pop shop. We use it all the time. You could be a 21-year-old running a lemonade stand or whatever. They'll call you mom and pop shop. And it doesn't have a negative connotation, but it makes it seem like you're not ambitious as a business. And I think that's so funny because Team Builder, you know, for all our nice digital advertising, a website and slick app, we're a mom and pop shop. We're 12 employees. And we reinvest a lot of money into the business. We're very ambitious. We're trying to grow this thing. We just don't necessarily feel like we have to take on the amount of risk that's being proposed to us in order to do it. So, but a lot of people do, you know, there's kind of an American business thing where like, we see some outliers, right, do really well and they become the standard somehow. Whereas, you know, if you make a good living for your family and you take the time off from work that you enjoy, I would consider that successful. So it's different, you know, it's a different perspective.
Yeah, 100%. I think, yeah, that is the saying in Australia. I think it's probably not as maybe aggressive and ambitious in Australia as in America. And I think probably in Australia, one difference is that I think you guys potentially because you have different laws over there as well, but like going under and like bankrupting a business, moving on to the next one is seen like much more of like a cool thing to do and very commonplace in America. Whereas I think the rules here about bankruptcy are like a bit harsher on the person that's gone bankrupt. The consequences are a bit more severe. And it's maybe just not as like a cool thing to like go under and move on to the next thing and, you know, leave people out of pocket. Yeah. So I do think, yeah, it's a little bit different here, but there's definitely a bit of that, what you said. And it's huge in fitness and gyms as well. And it's cool you said it because, yeah, some gyms can just do really, really well. And the worst thing they could probably do is try and open a second gym. But some people feel just obligated. Well, they're like, well, I need to be on the same track as F45. They've gone public. I've still got only one gym with one employee. I'm like, I really need to get moving here.
It's true. I mean, ambition can feel really good. It could also, I think, hinder your ability to make decisions. But it's generally a good thing to have. I think it's better than not having ambition, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, no, that's really cool. So just to be really be clear for us, so you think that for the average person, they have a, not average really, someone with a bit of a following online, because that's the person I think that really thinks about, I need to go online. They have a following in person with their gym. They have a following online. Unless you have a technical background or you can bring somebody into this, if you want to just, you know, make more money and to succeed with your business online, for most of these people, it's going to be easier to use an app that's already out there.
I 100% do. I want to use an example. One of my customers, Jared Moon, he runs End of Three Fitness. End of Three Fitness only sells, do you know them?
Oh, yeah.
That is such a good business. He has so many customers.
But just tell everyone what will they do?
Yeah. So Garage Gym Athlete is like their flagship product. And it's for people who train at home in like a garage gym, for instance. Yeah. I think the pitch is that if you have a barbell, you can train with us. I think he sells it for $25 a month flat.
Yep.
It's a very low point, and he has a lot of customers. So he uses Team Builder for the program distribution, but I know quite a bit about the other platforms that he uses. And I can tell you, he doesn't build these himself. Yes, he built the system, but he didn't build the infrastructure that supports his system. There's enough tools out there to where you can build your funnels. You can, you know, have a CRM that accurately, you know, puts your customers into the right buckets. You can communicate effectively with them. I've seen it happen. Jared Moon is doing it. So I think it's more about putting time and effort into putting together a system for yourself. And that's not necessarily an easy task either. If there are five components to your system and there's a bunch of vendors or suppliers that could be any one of those components, and you're sifting through a lot of things to see what works for you. But an efficient system is way more satisfying than going through the process of having to build your own system on a technical basis, right? That, in my opinion, is a fool's errand. There might be someone out there who's done it and they would call me a fool for saying that, but I just don't see it that often. But I see a lot of people making really good money who just put their system carefully in place together because they went through the process of evaluating everyone and building it.
I'd agree. And it's, you know, it's like we've had him on the show, which is good. And you can just see.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, we've had him on the show. It's great. And tons of people follow those programs. And there's so many examples of that. I think we've had Marcus Philly on the show who's similar as well. And, you know, he's got huge fan base. And I think that if he's a really smart guy, I could imagine he probably could go and potentially build his own app for it, but he wouldn't be making videos 24/7 shirtless, absolutely shredded. You know, he probably would have let himself go in the stress of building this app, probably wouldn't have had the time to, you know, come up with these crazy exercises, and then he wouldn't have acquired all these new customers. And if your goal is just like keep getting people in shape, you know, making more money, have a bigger impact, it sounds like you just, it might not be the path for everybody.
You take our company, for example. We have 5 super talented developers all here in the States, really talented engineers. Okay, so their time is finite. So we have to think about how do we allocate their time to create the best return for us. That time will be spent building Team Builder, nothing else. If we need some sort of internal tool and there's another vendor out there that can do it, I'm going to go pay those guys. Mm. I'm never going to turn to my developers and ask them to build something that doesn't create the most ROI. The most ROI for us is working on our core business. Anything that supports that core business, that's going to get outsourced or it's going to be third-partied.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so switching gears a bit, tell me, where do you see the whole sort of programming and like online fitness delivery space going? It might be where like you guys may be putting your long-term focus, or you just think, hey, this is definitely where it's going. I'm not sure if it's been changed by COVID, or it's more of like a bit of a bump in the road for you guys, probably like a surge in the road maybe. But where do you see it going?
We got a pretty good surge. I was just thinking about this the other day, actually. This new app, Future app. Mm. It's not competitive with us per se, but it's interesting. You could download this app and then just sift through all these trainers and read their backgrounds. I knew about it because one of my customers, who was a collegiate strength coach here, now is full-time trainer with the Future app. And if you read his background and you like it, you can choose him and hire him, and you pay $150 through the app, I believe. So I was looking through it and I was like, okay, this is good. This is not too different, you know, from purchasing training from someone, except you get to right there in the app, choose your trainer, whoever it is. But what the Future app is doing well with is that it's adding individualization to the training program that you're buying. And you can do that today, but at $150 and choosing your trainer and then talking to him like that frequently within the app, that feels like a very personalized experience. So the future of the fitness industry as it relates to apps and applications is how personalized and specific can you make your services feel without actually draining your time to provide all that. So I'm kind of thinking of like the services that trainers give as like modular, like, this is a guy, young male, he wants to get bigger. He likes this equipment, so he does this strength training program. He tends to like these foods or whatever, so he's going to use this diet plan that's going to definitely put him at a caloric deficit. And he owns this device that tracks his sleep, so I'm going to connect it to that, and we're going to get his sleep data in here. I like that personal experience. I would like it myself. And I think the more affordable you can make that and the more scalable you can allow trainers to be while delivering that personal experience, I think the apps that do the best job at that are going to be the ones that win in the end. Mm. And I'm looking at Team Builder like that, and I'm really, you know, wanting to continue that route.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a parallel that we've talked about even on the show, which is probably for fitness as well. The future does seem to be a bit more individualized with things. So obviously had a huge rise of group fitness. You know, to be fair, there's not a lot individualized about, say, CrossFit or a good boxing studio or like an F45 studio, right? Pretty much nothing in there. It's just like, hey, you do an on-ramp and then you train and it's a wad, right? Like it's the whole premise of it is not individualized. You compare it, but not individualized. But a lot of people feel, and actually what we feel with our new gym locker room as well, is that the future is people want to pay for more individualization.
I do. I train now. I buy some training programs from a strength coach here in the States, but I'm really close to wanting a more individual approach to things because, again, I feel like I'm kind of outsourcing it. I have the time and energy now, but as my company grows, as I enjoy other hobbies, and as you know, my family grows, I'm going to find someone to do that for me, to kind of be more instructional, and it's going to be worth the money. It 100% will be.
Yeah. And do you think that a lot of that individualization will come from technology itself, where you just like, it's okay, whatever, you know, I got your Whoop looked into this. I can see you slept bad last night. And I know you're like a bit overweight because I got your weight and I got your step count from the health app. So today is like a deload day.
I would like for it to be. Yeah. I really would. I want these trainers to do well and have a good business and have, you know, 30, 40, 50 clients, but do a good job for each one of them. And I think technology is the key to making that happen for them. I'm thinking, I'm envisioning a dashboard where I can just get someone 7 days sleep average plus last night's sleep, some good, you know, macro averages, and then some compliance data on how they complied with the workouts and how hard they were. That would be a dream, you know, for a trainer, and a dream for me as a client. Like, if I want the best out of my trainer, I want all that data to be very digestible and concise and available to them. So yeah, I think technology plays a big role in making that happen for clients and trainers.
And the truth is, it's pretty much already there. It's just the pulling it all together across 9 different applications.
You nailed it. You nailed it. It's someone has to do it. Yeah. I want to do it. This might be the only reason I raise capital for my company is if I just see the opportunity and no one's doing it, and like, let me just do this. Let me connect the Whoops, the Apple Watches, the everything's. Let's get the MyFitnessPal nutrition integration. Yeah. Let's build a dashboard. And let's do it at a smaller price than Smartabase is doing it, which, let's be real, the only people who afford Smartabase are, you know, Super Rugby.
What's Smartabase?
Smartabase is what they call an AMS, an athlete management system.
Yep.
Essentially, it's a software platform that aggregates data from many, many sources.
Wow.
And they have these very, very customizable dashboards in there. The only people that you will see using Smartabase will be like the Australian Institute of Sport, the AFL teams, the Super Rugby teams, Rugby League, and here in the States, military professional teams. It's expensive, is what I'm saying.
Okay. Yeah.
But if some, because they hire a lot of people, it's not an easy task to do what they do. But, you know, if I could do that and put it at a price point that serves a larger market, it would be fantastic. It would be a really good business. I don't mind saying it out loud because, you know, it's not an idea that's valuable. It's the execution of this one that matters.
Yeah, of course. It's pretty obvious, I think, for nearly everybody. It's like, oh, dude, I wish I could just...
It's very obvious, yeah.
And I feel like this is cool because you've got a bit of insight into it. How far off do you think, because I think this will really be a huge change for the industry as well, is any sort of coaching of technique that is not from an individual person? So say with, you know, team builder, like say I could upload, not saying with you guys, but just in general, upload a video of my front squat and I'll get some feedback back that, okay, your hip shifting to the right, or this is kind of going wrong, which is just, you know, generally widely regarded as bad technique, but someone's not reviewing it. It's like the iPhone's got the ability to see that poor technique.
Yeah, that'd be cool. It'd be tough though. Cause when you start building AI into like video analysis, there's going to be limitations. You know, the AI is fantastic when it comes to evaluating human movement. I think you probably still want a human there. Also at the same time, I don't know how necessarily valuable it is to do technique. I don't know. It just seems like a lot of effort technologically for like very little yield as it relates to like a coach's business. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, I guess so. I just thought, you know, if like on a daily basis, you could pick up small changes through video without somebody watching, you could prevent injuries. You know, you could just potentially see a lot more progress more quickly than having like to pay some, you know, because most people can't afford to have somebody watching their videos.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I've probably talked to coaches that are more interested in the results. For clients. I don't know. It's a good question. I'm just trying to draw on some of my personal experience here. The video in our instance in Team Builder is utilized as a way to compare quality of movement over time. It's a way to add like a qualitative aspect to the quantitative. Yes, they're getting stronger, but their form's still shitty. Like, is my client still being a better human, physically speaking? That's where video, I think, would come in, is assessing quality of movement over time. That's where people, I think, get a lot of it. Because you can say, hey, I worked with this person for 2 years and they got stronger. But more importantly, look at their shitty squat form when I first started working with them and look at their squat now. And that is a whole different dimension to kind of showing your work or, you know, proving your worth as a coach or trainer.
Yeah, for sure. It's the real before and after. Kind of transition as well. I want to just get into before we finish is you obviously have a lot of coaches that use the platform. You've probably got some that suck and they can barely keep their 3 clients. And then you got some kind of like Jared Moon, would just have like wild success with their programs.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a few lessons maybe you've drawn in the last 18 months during COVID that the really successful coaches are doing, A, for acquiring new customers, because obviously that's one part of it, but then also keeping clients on programs long-term? We all know that can be the hardest part of it.
That's a very hard part of it. So when it comes to acquiring clients, good marketing always kind of wins. Good marketing is just really hard to beat. Good marketing is authentic. It's honest. It's not necessarily gimmicky, right? That's not what I'm saying. But coaches who understand their brand and understand their value proposition and then communicate that really well through marketing. And during COVID, I think video was like a really big thing. You know, if you could create video and incorporate video into your marketing and visually represent your brand, I think you did really well for yourself. So coaches who enjoy the process of having a website that's up to date on best practices, marketing and inbound lead capture, and having a funnel process that gives people an experience that they are confident that they're funneling themselves into the right program for them. Those coaches do well at acquiring because they understand that process. They're essentially pseudo professional marketers, which you have to be. It's unfortunately, you know, hopefully you agree with this, but like the best program, the best written program doesn't always win in the end.
Yeah.
The person who's got the best marketing and sells you whatever program that is, like they're going to do well. That's kind of how it goes. When it comes to keeping customers in the long term, results are definitely key. But loyalty to the brand, I think you have to create some sort of loyalty to it. I think a brute strength. You know, Kara, who you mentioned before we got on, is I think one of their representative athletes. Brute calls it the tribe, right? Once you start doing brute programs, you're in the brute tribe. They give you a patch. You put that patch on your backpack. You're in a group where you're going to get coaching that no one else is allowed to at all, right? People feel loyal to the Brute brand. I think they like the athletes that Brute associates with. They like that, you know, they call it a tribe. There's some level of exclusivity to it. That's important for brand loyalty. It definitely is. And, you know, I think to have a good brand, you have to understand it. You can't make it up out of thin air. You kind of have to understand like why people like you in the first place and what they come to you for in the first place, and then just kind of leverage that to make it work for you.
Yeah. I think particularly with programs, something that you probably can't just start running good ads for straight away. You've really got to have like some real reason, because it's different to maybe just like buying a kind of gimmicky or like a mattress or something, like something you just put in the house. Like a program is something you really want to buy into if you're going to like sweat daily, wake up early, go to the gym and trust them, you know, with your effort.
Yeah. Yeah. It takes a lot of self-reflection, you know, to understand like what you, as a business owner, like what is my brand? Like, you know, how do we talk? What words do we use? What do we stand for? It takes some self-reflection. People probably skip over that. I mean, it's the most fun part of business is coming up with a sweet logo. That's what everyone loves that, right? Cause like it's my sweet logo. I love it. All these young entrepreneurs already have it. They come to me without a business, but they already have a name for the business. They already have a logo for it. You know, those are the first things that people will do. But that's not your brand, right? Your brand is how you talk. It's how you describe yourself and talk to your customers or talk to your prospects. And the people who do a really good job of it that are pretty consistent, and they seem like they have a good idea of who they are and what their brand is. I think Jim Jones is another one that comes to mind. You know, they know who they are. You know, they're not sitting in boardrooms and thinking like, hey, is it time to, you know, change like how we talk about ourselves? Like it is what it is. And you're either in or you're out, you know, there's really no in between. And that's a pretty powerful concept when you're trying to build a community within your brand. And I'm thinking about the workouts that I do. I know a lot of strength coaches. I can get training programs from anywhere. It's kind of a commodity for me at this point, but I'm sort of loyal to the person that writes my programs because they've got a little bit of a brand to them. It's old school bodybuilding. They embrace that. And every little workout has a cardio at the bottom, and it's never cardio. It's like a joke. It's like down a steak. It is. It's like protein shake curls. Like it just makes fun of cardio, even though I still do cardio, but like, it's kind of part of that, that cheeky brand. And I like that. So I'm part of that community. I mean, I'm in. And if people show me their program, I say, that's awesome. Here's mine. And, you know, this is mine. I'm a part of this one. And that kind of feels good to kind of be a part of something.
Yeah, exactly. And because, I mean, at the end of the day, the programs aren't that different. I mean, they're different, but if you're going for like a strength program to, you know, improve your lifts in the gym, you know, if they're programming swimming, it's probably a bad program. Like they're going to look at the end of the day pretty similar.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. The programs, they're not all that different. They maybe are a little bit, but I could find a lot of programs that look just like the ones I'm doing. No problem. Yeah. There's a bunch out there, but this one's mine. You know, I'm a part of it, like I said. And, that's where it's like powerful to, I forget the book. I don't want to be the guy that like, you know, pulls book references all the time because I really don't read that often, but there's a book that's like, you know, communities will have like rituals in them and they don't necessarily have to mean anything, right? Like here we train in black. We wear all black when we train. That's just what we do. It means nothing, but it's a ritual. And since everyone's partaking in it, that in and of itself is powerful. So whether your ritual is what you wear or what you say, or what your workout movements are comprised of, as long as you're doing something together, that actually in and of itself is a ritual that creates community because you're doing it collectively. And that's kind of cool. You know, if you're a business owner, think about something, you might have rituals, you don't even realize it, but you know, that's part of your brand. It's part of your identity.
Yeah, it's really cool. I remember even just one gym in the States, which, you know, everything was normal except at the end of the class, they did this like kind of hands in like NFL style, like break, or sort of like celebration thing at the end of the gym class. Obviously now you'd never do that, but in the old days. And it was sick because it made it feel like a sports team. And I was like, oh, it's just like this 1 3-second, nothing to do with training, unique thing at the end of class. And that's like the number one thing I remember. The number one thing I was like, man, I understand why people stay at this gym.
Yeah, it's just, it's what we do. And, you know, you have to be in it to understand it kind of thing. Powerful. That's what creates tribes, right? Tribes are powerful. That's what a community is. And if you can create one, that's cool. Maybe the dynamic gets harder the larger the tribe gets. You know, I don't know. Peloton's got hundreds of thousands, if not millions of subscribers. Like, I don't know what that dynamic's like. I don't have any experience there. But that's interesting to me too.
I think their ritual is like, as soon as you get one, you tell all your friends that you've bought one. And then you remind them every time you do a workout. I think that's the ritual they've got.
Yeah, and you always get the plus, right? You never get the dumb bike. You get the smart one.
No, of course.
Yeah.
You're only smart if you get the smart one. Well, man, I really, really appreciate you coming back on the show. There was one thing we talked about as well is that people don't realize you guys have launched payments through the apps. And I think at a time when a lot of people in fitness are struggling because of COVID, particularly in Australia right now, really the whole country's locked down, you guys take 0% commission, which is the right percent, I think, to take away from coaches that are doing all the hard work for the programming. So I really appreciate you supporting the community. And I mean, online, I think for a lot of coaches in Australia right now is literally like saving their livelihood because it's illegal to train people in gyms. So really appreciate your help there. Is there anything else you want to leave the audience with?
No, I don't. I just love coming on the show. I mean, I love talking about all this. I love the mix of business and fitness. I don't necessarily love business by itself, and I don't necessarily love fitness by itself, but together that's where I get my energy from. So you guys can be a good platform to do that. I don't know if you'll have me on again, but if we do, I personally, in my life, I've gotten interested in kind of, you know, competing again. I played football collegiately here in the States. And when I was done in my early 20s, I was pretty burnt out to the point where I didn't really have a competitive mindset at any point after college football. And then I started realizing I was enjoying.
So were you playing college? Was that soccer or like American football with the helmets?
Oh, I'm sorry. American football. American football. And then I started realizing that I enjoyed playing golf and I liked taking it seriously. I liked practicing. And then I started, you know, playing a little bit competitively. And I felt like reintroducing myself to what it means to kind of compete again, to take a sport seriously and to practice with intent and purpose.
And how old were you roughly when you decided to make that change? Give me some perspective.
I picked up golf maybe like 3 or 4 years ago. And I didn't get competitive right away. I kind of had to work my way into it. And then only within the last 2 years did I start feeling like I needed to put a little bit of time and money into kind of feeling like I had, you know, like a sense of purpose when I went out there to play. But it's been fun and it's been different, man. Having a competitive athlete mindset is a little bit different than being a business owner. I found, I'm not a very good competitive athlete I found. So I feel like the next couple of years I want to work towards, being having a good competitive mind again. So it'll be interesting to see.
Do you think that competitive outlet improves you when you come back to the business? Because it's like, it keeps you sharp or keeps you competitive in some way.
I think it's hard to tell yet. I think I'm at the part of the learning curve where I'm overcoming challenges and trying to maintain a positive attitude more than I'm seeing like benefits from engaging in that process. Because there aren't many material consequences to like competing poorly or preparing poorly. Like I still come home and I have my business and I have my life and I have stuff, but I still want to do well. So it's on me and no one else to still go out there and focus and be intentional and try to be a good competitor. And, processing positive thoughts versus negative ones, it's an interesting exercise. And I've realized that, like, it's a journey. It's not like I could just flip the switch and become a college football player again. I kind of have to begin, being conscious of how I think and my thoughts and stuff like that. That's been really interesting.
It is cool. Yeah. I think a lot of people in fitness, probably 90% started as some sort of competitive athlete in something. And then, I think sometimes when you see an athlete training all day, a bit unnecessarily, they're not signed up for anything. It's because they are filling that void that competitive sports left for them,
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know why I got interested again in kind of competing. And when I say competing on a very amateur basis, I mean, like I said, there are no consequences. It's not a big part of my identity yet, but I do find that when you dig deep in your mind, there's a lot of thoughts going on, and it's almost like meditation. Like you have to observe your thoughts rather than associate with all of your thoughts, because you're going to have negative thoughts, you're going to have positive ones. And that, I feel like that ought to be everyone that's a human,
Yeah. And I'm sure with golf, just in particular, there's a bit more of that.
There is a bit more of that. I think so. Because it's very isolated. It's you versus yourself and the course, and you're not reacting to anything. You're predicting things, and the outcomes are never what you want. So that's been different too, because football was a totally different experience. And now I'm experiencing a very different sort of sport. And that's been a good challenge, and I've enjoyed it. It's a good challenge.
Probably smart you chose a safer sport as well.
I was just talking to someone about this today. Football is not a safe sport. It's a lot of fun. It's
definitely not.
And I don't die to go out there and do something as extreme as football, I'm totally fine not having to have contact or feel pain to kind of feel like I'm competing or playing a sport. I don't feel the need for that, which I guess is a really good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right, man. Well, I really appreciate you coming back on the show. We love following Tim Builder's success. I guess as you like add more features to the app, it's cool because talk to you about it, but we also just see it straight away because obviously we're users of the product as well. So I wish you the best success with that. And hopefully, maybe for the round three, we'll be in person one day.
That would be amazing. You come to me or I come to you. Hopefully I can come to you.
Man, I think you need to come to us. We've done a few trips. Where are you in the States?
I'm in Colorado.
We'd love to go there. Maybe we'll come to you. We'll come to you.
All right, we'll just do a switch. Yeah. We'll swap it up.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, fella.
All right, buddy.
Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the My Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the My Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themindmuscleproject.com/The After Show. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.